Russia's opposition scored a decisive victory in Yaroslavl's mayoral election this week when Maverick City Council deputy Yevgeny Urlashov won nearly 70% of the vote, crushing the United Russia-backed candidate. Here's Urlashov speaking to supporters after his win.
There are a lot of people who are calling me now, sending SMSs. I'm very grateful to them, to everybody who believed that change could start in Yaroslavl. I think Yaroslavl is where the changes in the country will start. This is not just about politics. People simply want a new life. People would like to have normal roads. They want public services to function well. They want authorities to treat them well and to stop stealing. So I'll start fighting corruption here quite seriously.
Urlashov was supported by a broad coalition of parties, including the Communists, the liberal pro-Western Yabloko Party, and the center-left Just Russia. He also had backing of billionaire oligarch Mikhail Prokhorov, as well as the civic organization Democratic Choice. The win was all the more impressive, however, considering that Urlashov faced a media blackout, a series of dirty tricks like fake campaign literature being distributed and put out in his name, and a persistent harassment from the police. He relied on meetings with voters in courtyards of apartment blocks and focused on bread-and-butter issues. The opposition clearly sees the result as a sign of things to come. Opposition figure Vladimir Milov recently wrote on his blog that the road to the Kremlin runs through Yaroslavl. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
The electoral uprising in Yaroslavl came hot on the heels of a string of victories for opposition candidates in the region, including mayoral elections in the auto-making city of Tolyatti and in the town of Chernogolovka in the Moscow Oblast. It also came after opposition candidates won a third of the open seats in elections to district councils in Moscow itself. And the opposition in the region is clearly getting more assertive when they believe electoral victories have been stolen from them. 20 activists in the southern Russian city of Astrakhan are on hunger strike over alleged vote fraud in local elections there. In the wake of the Yaroslavl election, political analyst Masha Lipman noted that United Russia is increasingly, quote, a losing brand in the regions. Kirill, two things seem to be going on here. First, the opposition appears to be getting much better at contesting elections at the local level. And second, United Russia looks like increasingly like a spent force. And 6 months down the road in October, we have regional and municipal elections throughout Russia in which some big prizes, like the mayorship of the oil-rich city of Krasnoyarsk, are up for grabs. Is the ruling elite in trouble in the regions, Kirill? And if so, what can they do to regain the initiative, if anything?
I can't say this about the elite, ruling elite in the regions, because we have to divide elite from United Russia. Of course, now it's the same, but not in the future. I try to explain the situation. First of all, the main problem with United Russia, especially in Russian regions, is that they just replaced the local authorities with themselves, with the party. And as a result, all this disappointment of the population, of the economic situation, social situation, inequality, corruption, and so on, is focused now on United Russia. Not on the local councils or local mayors and so on, but focus on the very party. It's the result of the 12 years of the policy when United Russia is everything in the Russian government. That is the result.
So they're like the new Communist Party, and we're in 1991?
Yes. I don't like this.
89, 88?
I don't like these comparisons. All historical comparisons as a historian.
I know yes, you're a historian, and I was provoking you.
Yes. It's absolutely rubbish, because every phenomena of historical process is absolutely unique. But speaking seriously, what goes on there? People, they are tired of the situation in the cities and towns and countryside and whatever. And they are voting not for someone, as in Urlashov's case, but against something or someone. In this case, this is the voting against United Russia and eventually against the recent situation in the Russian economics and social sphere.
So is this a situation that can be alleviated from the perspective of the ruling elite just by a rebranding? I mean, we've seen rebrandings of the party of power several times over the last couple of decades. I mean, you had Dem Vyborosi, Russia's choice, was the party of power at one time, as hard as that may be to believe. Nash Dom Rossi, our home is Russia, was the party. And now United Russia, which has been, you must admit, the most successful of those three enterprises. Are we just in for another rebranding, a new name with the same faces, or is something more radical going to be?
United Russia was the most successful of them, of all of them, because the situation changed in the very beginnings of 2000s. What's going on now? I think that United Russia, and that is my prognosis, United Russia as a serious political party is done. Yes, and I think that Putin now is thinking about something else. Look all of these rebrandings on the political spectrum, and especially all these discussions around so-called United People's Front, rebranding of this movement and organization. In the context of the new legislation about political parties, where all the people in Russia are allowed to found their own political party.
Anybody with 500 friends.
Yes, it's
Facebook.
Okay. It's okay. Facebook, Facebook politics, yes. In this situation, I think the trick is that Putin and his circle, they try to make a new political landscape in which there will be a lot of very small, very tiny political parties and movements, from Mikhail Prokhorov's party to some, I don't know, subtropical political party founded by Vladimir Prebelovsky.
Yes.
on this background will be the real people's organization. That will be the United People's
the
Front.
The Popular Front.
Yes, yeah, Popular Front. And there is no any place for United Russia in this situation.
So are we going to be seeing a situation like we had in the 90s in which, okay, our home Russia, Nash Dom Rossi, was the formal party of power, but there were really a lot of little satellites and clones out there that were actually Kremlin projects to siphon votes and what have you. The biggest example of this, of course, is Vladimir Zhirinovsky's allegedly nationalist.
Yes, but don't forget that the main enemy in 1990s was the Communist Party of Russia, but not now. The communists, they are slowly but dying. Not just the electorate because of their old age and so on, but and the party organization itself. And the only way to revive Communist Party is to allow new leaders, some kind of, I don't know, like Sergei Udaltsov and so on.
Yes, and so on.
In this case, it will be a serious political force, but not now. And I think that Putin and his aides, they're thinking about this, and they want to have a new political landscape consists of a lot of tiny political movements and organizations and group, and one powerful, this United Popular Front,
which will replace United Russia. So this is a rebranding, so to speak, then.
No, because United Russia is a political party with some fractions, with a liberal wing, with a conservative wing, with whatever, and they really have some inner discussions in the party. But United Popular Front is just a movement. It's not a real political party. It's a kind of, it's a part or maybe a main tool of a new populist project by Vladimir Putin for forthcoming 6 years of his rule.
Well, how do you see this working then? You'll have the Popular Front infiltrating all sorts of different parties that will join this front? How is this going to work in practice?
I don't know. I think that one of the matrices which they have before their eyes thinking about this Popular Front is a historical experience of such regimes as Mussolini's regime in Italy, Salazar regimes in Portugal, and so on. Don't forget that the ruling parties of movement in these countries, in these authoritarian regimes, were a kind of mix of political party and trade unions.
Mm-hmm. Classic corporatism.
Yes, yeah, corporatism and Perón's regime in Argentina.
You've named three very disturbing models for
I'm not optimist, you know. I'm not claiming that all this project will be successful. Mm-hmm. And that's why I can propose you to return to Yaroslavl case. Because it's very interesting because you just spoke about some historical comparisons and analogies and so on. Came to me that, do you remember the history of 1612, this liberating of Moscow of Polish occupants.
I don't remember it, but I'm aware of it.
Yes. if you remember the main movement which liberated Moscow from Polish occupants, was Nizhegorodskaya Polchenia, the militia, popular militia from Nizhny Novgorod. A very few people remember that the year before this, Nizhegorodskaya Polchenia, this Nizhny Novgorod militia, was Yaroslavl militia, who didn't succeed. And they still had a camps near Moscow in 1612 when Minin and his Nizhegorodsky guys came to Moscow. It's just a joke, but just remember.
So was Milov right that the road to the Kremlin goes through Yaroslavl?
That's why I just remember this historical fact because of Milov and so on.
We say that history does not repeat itself, but
never.
But it echoes.
Some echoes, and you
and
can
it rhymes,
and you can use it for your political aims. Don't forget about this infamous Putin speech in Luzhniki when he remembered Borodino battle and whatever. So why not to remember Yaroslavl militia?
So what are you saying? What is the implication here that what happened in Yaroslavl will be something that upsets these grand plans that you're saying that Putin has for the new political landscape? Or is he already incorporating, do you think, this into the plans?
In some sense, I think they have to be, it's interesting, but happy, Putin and his aides, with these results, because it's one more point in support of the idea of this united popular front against the existence of united Russia. But on the other side, of course, it's great that the opposition figure or character won the Yaroslavl mayor elections. But one thing, as I told you, this electorate, people in Yaroslavl, they voted not just for Urlashov, they voted against the recent situation. And then the next step will be, can this Urlashov do something in Yaroslavl, in this situation in Russia, with this enormous corruption, without help of any political organization on part? I don't know what about business and who is supporting you just in Yaroslavl and so on, but it could be the same plot as it was with Nikita Bilyk in Kirov region.
Well, this is one of the things, because he did run on, and if you listen to the quote we were listening to at the beginning of the podcast, he was talking about these bread and butter issues. He's saying, you know, the people want to have good roads and good schools and good public services.
Good intentions.
He campaigned on these very, very, what we call in English, bread and butter issues. Right. He being blocked out of the media, he was meeting voters in the courtyards of apartment blocks. And I couldn't help but be reminded, of course, it was, again, very different, and this is not a direct historical comparison, but of Boris Yeltsin and his rise when he was riding the metro in Moscow. Yeah, yeah. Now, we all know what happened to Boris Yeltsin once he got in the Kremlin. And
but don't forget what happened eventually with Yeltsin.
What?
What, in the end of 90s?
Well, no, that's what I mean. We can't forget what happened to Yeltsin when he got to the Kremlin. Yeah. And what you're suggesting here is that people like Urlashov are going to get co-opted into the whatever new order Putin is dreaming up and his political advisors are dreaming up.
Yes, I think that this, first of all, this Urlashov is a very, very talented and gifted politician. Anyway, his rhetoric is very good in a Russian situation. He is trying to avoid nationalistic tunes of this rhetoric. And it's very important because even Navalny, using this lexics and so. Secondly, if any political organization, opposition political organization in Russia will support Urlashov in future, it will be a good chance for him and for opposition forces also.
And who becomes governor of Yaroslav Oblast is also
interesting.
Because if he has the support of a governor, yes, that makes all the difference.
Usually in Russian province, there are a lot of conflicts between mayors and governors.
Governors.
No, even if they're the members of the same United Russia
yes,
Party.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm not sure about this. And the third point is that in we'll speak about future, all these elections in Krasnoyarsk and so on this autumn.
Yeah.
I can predict a very serious struggle in these regions, especially in Krasnoyarsk, which is one of the most powerful bases of Mikhail Prokhorov and all his movement.
It's also the richest region in Russia outside of Moscow.
Yeah, yes. It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Mr. Prokhorov, because one of the common denominators in all of these elections, be it in Tolyatti or Yaroslavl or what have you, is that Prokhorov seems to be the one supporting the opposition candidate.
He has to play an active role.
He's playing a very active role, and that makes me and you, again, you can't avoid conspiracies. When you talk about Russia, yeah. A very wise political analyst once told me there's never a question in Russia if there's a conspiracy. It's a question of which conspiracy is succeeding at any given moment. And you have to wonder, given Mr. Prokhorov's long ties to the Kremlin and the fact that you don't become a billionaire in Russia by accident, and if you want to remain being a billionaire, you have to be pretty careful. You have to wonder if Prokhorov is what he's doing right now. I mean, I think he's being a political entrepreneur and playing both sides very cleverly or for the time being. But as you mentioned, maybe the Kremlin was happy about Urlashov's win in Yaroslavl because it can fit into this new configuration of with the United Front with many, many, many different political forces in the country. What do you think of Prokhorov's role here?
I'm not sure that now his role is very important, but he is playing, as we told, a very active role in all these events, because now he's founding or establishing a new political party. And,
yes,
with the help of social networking and so on. By the way, his aides and his political experts are extremely silly in the social networking. By the way,
they're silly.
Just read his Twitter account and so on. It's just as you're reading some kind of report of the Komsomol meeting in 1983.
Uh-huh.
Yes, all these words, lexics and tunes and whatever, they're just so outdated,
uh-huh.
So wooden. You know, uh-huh. This деревянный in
yeah,
Russian.
No,
yeah,
no, wooden. That's the right word.
So, but it's just by the way, uh-huh. I think they will have to improve all this campaign. But now he is establishing or founding his own political party. If he want to survive somehow, not just as one of the instruments of Kremlin, but as a semi-independent political figure, he has to be active everywhere. He has to participate in every regional event, such as elections and so on, because he knows that part of Moscow population is already supporting him. And he will never win more support in Moscow and St. Petersburg than he...
So he's bolstering his support in the regions now. He's collecting favors.
He has to expand his influence or his name, even his name, to the farthest regions of Russia, not just Krasnoyarsk, because Krasnoyarsk, population of Krasnoyarsk know him very well, very well, but to Tambov, Yaroslavl, whatever. And
right.
That is the only way to him to become a real politician in Russia.
Well, Mr. Prokhorov's role is something we certainly want to keep an eye on right now.
Sure.
And we also want to keep an eye on to what extent the authorities get prepared for those October elections. The opposition was able to slip under the radar, especially on March 4th when all eyes were on the presidential election. But that's all we have time for today on this topic. In a few moments, we'll take a look at another story that's making news in Russia this week, as the Orthodox Church and Patriarch Kirill find themselves under fire over, of all things, an expensive wristwatch. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Sometimes your own words can come back to haunt you. Here's Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill speaking in August 2010 about the dangers of seeking wealth and earthly pleasure.
Everything that we see today, everything that looks so alluring, all that rich and dissolute life, all of that is the devil's bait that destroys the human soul.
Well, this week, Russian bloggers noted that Kirill himself was wearing some of that devil's bait on his arm in the form of a 30,000 euro wristwatch. The watch caused a bit of a stir a few years back when it was first spotted, and Kirill, who said it was a gift from a wealthy parishioner, pledged not to wear it anymore. But is he keeping his promise? Bloggers noted that in a photo of Kirill on the church's website, the watch was airbrushed out, but not its reflection on a polished tabletop where Kirill was sitting, suggesting that he is still wearing the controversial watch after all. This made a lot of stir this week in the Russian media and the blogosphere, Kirill, but it's really about much more than a wristwatch, isn't it?
Yes. First of all, let's speak about the reflections, not about the watch. my first question is, what's the time now? And you look at your wrist watch. Sorry, but it's a cheap one. It's old one,
it's not that old, and it's not that cheap.
Okay. how much? 30,000
euro? No, not even close. It cost about 4,000 Czech crowns. By my standards, that is a normal price for a wristwatch.
Yes. Speaking seriously, both of us, we are employees of a radio, yes, and we have to know time every second of our life because it's a part of our everyday routine. Yes, because we are journalists, we're working for radio, and so on.
In fact, our producer was just reminding me of the time.
Sure. Yes, but. Could you imagine any second of Patriarch Kirill's life when he's not surrounding by gadgets like, smartphones, TV screens, computer screens, his aides, or whatever, is not surrounded by watches? Why on earth he is wearing a wrist watch?
At all. Even like my...
Yes, absolutely.
I like my watch.
Absolutely.
So cheap, even my cheap watch.
Can you imagine Patriarch Kirill alone, absolutely alone, somewhere in the closed room without any watches?
Not knowing what time it is. Yes. No, I couldn't. Yes. So you're saying it's just an accessory, it's an accoutrement?
Absolutely. Secondly, this kind of thing, yes, very expensive, symbolically expensive wristwatch. It's a part of a style, sorry, Patriarch Kirill, but it's a part of a gangster style in Russia in 1990s. Because these expensive watches, Breguet or whatever, Rolex, that was a part of a lifestyle of Russian gangsters or half semi-gangsters in 1990s. It's a sign of the status.
Did you see, by the way, what Ksenia Sobchak tweeted today about Patriarch Kirill? She said he is like, I'm trying to remember, the general director of a tax-free trading company.
Yes. Yes. She's right in some other sense too. Yes. Especially in noting about this tax-free.
The operative word tax-free.
For sure. In some historical or maybe in some kind socio-cultural sense, Patriarch Kirill, as all his organization, he lives in 1990s. culturally, the state of mind. They're trying to surround themselves with luxury. They like to be inside the luxurious life. And that is not just against all the foundations of the Christian faith. And, of course, it's not the things that Jesus Christ or Francis of Assisi told to the believers. No. But we are not going to be involved in some millennium dispute about the wealth of church and so on. But
this doesn't come in isolation. I mean, just months ago, a Russian undercover investigation by Russian television revealed that an Orthodox priest in Kazan owned a BMW and a Mercedes Jeep, three flats, a country house. Another priest was secretly filmed bragging about his prohibitively expensive Swiss watch and his penchant for Italian designer clothing. Now, I don't want to say priests aren't allowed to have nice things, but this does kind of
remember Renaissance popes,
right? Yeah,
yes. But we are speaking not just from the theological point of view. We are speaking from the social and political and cultural points of view. So let's speak about Russian Orthodox Church as an organization which has or doesn't have its own strategy in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And in this sense, you can speak that...
You mean social strategy.
Yes, social strategy, yeah. You can say that Catholic Church, of course, it has a very strong and powerful social ideology. Yes, it's leftist.
Mm-hmm. It's leftist on some matters, it's rightist
on
others.
Yes, yes, it's about inequality and so
on.
It's
on economic matters,
it's left. If you think about even the Islamist movements, all of them, they have their very strong social message.
Well, yeah, if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or Hamas, they, where do they get their power? It's from delivering social services.
Yeah. Speaking very primitively, they're against the riches for and for the poor. Yeah?
Largely.
If we remember, I don't know, if we recall some Protestant churches, even the Calvinist one, they're sending a very strong social messages to the poor. And, of course, Buddhist churches but not Russian Orthodox Church.
Why?
Because I think the modern Orthodox Church is the real product not of the pre-Soviet period of time, not even Soviet period of time. It's the real product of 1990s, with all this cult of money and luxury and so on.
They're the last Novorussiyski.
Of course, the last new Russians. You're absolutely right. I don't want to insult all clergy of the Russian Orthodox Church. Of course, there are a lot of very good people who are thinking about people, about the believers, and about the economic and social state in the country, and so on. But the elite of Russian Orthodox Church, I think, is real product of 1990s. They, in their mind,
when they made a lot of money having tax for importing cigarettes, if my memory serves me correctly.
Yes, and all this context of Russian life in 1990s, where the only way to be sound was to be wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a way a church can be.
Now, when you speak of the Russian Orthodox Church, we're not just talking about a church. We're talking about a social institution in Russia.
And we're speaking about social institution, not
a
religious institution.
And a political institution. And a political institution that is tied closely to the authorities. I mean, the Kirill was very close to President Medvedev. And he got a lot out of the authorities during Medvedev's presidency in terms of getting religious education into the schools, into the army, getting a lot of the church's property back.
For instance, this story, this awful story with Children's Hospital.
Of course, I wanted to bring that up. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean,
it's one of the, I think, not few stories that property, which was the church property before the
Soviet revolution,
of course, and there is kind of a process of the restitution, the restitution of this property to the church. But now, on this ground, existed a children's hospital for seriously ill children.
Uh-huh.
And now the monastery is just pushing this hospital from this premises.
Yeah. And what do they want to do with this space?
Just to expand this monastery.
So they're not going to preserve the hospital administer the hospital.
I don't know, but they, I don't know, but they don't speak about this.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the situation.
Because, you know, the Catholic Church runs a lot of hospitals and schools and things like this. We don't see this with the Orthodox.
They have some of them, but not as a rule. It's not the rule. In social sense, a Russian Orthodox Church is very ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they try to be at the place where they are now, but not to expand, their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
They are doing this very good, but not to expand their influence. But influence is not just the religious one. Influence is a social one.
Mm-hmm.
Influence is cultural one, and all this. Sorry, but silly remarks about Mozart from
referring to Chaplin's comments about how Mozart was the Britney Spears of his time. I don't know
why
what
not,
provoked
why
that.
Not he knows about Britney Spears.
Good question.
It's interesting. Yes.
Judging from his comment, he doesn't
know. Maybe he was watching TV in 1990s. Secretly.
Yeah, this does seem to support. It seems from that comment he doesn't know much about Mozart either.
But he's a very educated guy, by the way. And all this story around, the scandal around Pussy Riots and so on, all these absolutely silly movements, they just destabilize the situation and the common attitude in Russia towards the...
Well, the church now is saying they're under attack from anti-Orthodox forces around the country, and they're putting all of these scandals that have come to light in the context of the Pussy Riot incident at the Christ the Savior Church in Moscow. Allegedly, priests have been attacked and churches have been desecrated in various regions of Russia. We actually have a correspondent investigating this right now. So they're putting this in the context of we're under attack, we're under assault. This is an assault on religion. Is this going to work?
I think it's usual rhetoric based on a paranoid way of thinking. When you're picking up some random facts,
mm-hmm.
and then connecting them with mm-hmm. some idea that you already invented before this,
right?
That's not the real explanation. There is no any special campaign against Russian Orthodox Church. This is not the attacks on the churches in the Russian regions, mm-hmm. because it's an ongoing process. You can remember 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, there was some kind of absolutely brutal and violent attacks on the clergy in Rязань and so mm-hmm. on.
Well, if
not
you go
now,
back to
yes.
the early 19,
yes.
late 80s, early 90s, the yes, Father Mien, Alexander Mien.
Yeah, a lot of them. I'm speaking about this mocking campaign focused on Patriarch Kirill and mm-hmm. so on. This is just a normal reaction on this all the silliness of the church course and social politics and rhetorics. Yeah.
Now, the church does have, the Orthodox Church does have a tradition of social activism in the
yes.
past. I mean, Father Gapon is the most
yeah.
famous example from the revolution of 1905. But more recently, as I mentioned, Father Alexander Mien was very, very who was tragically murdered in towards the end of the Soviet
yeah.
period.
Yeah.
But there is this tradition, and if I understand correctly, there is a younger generation coming up of clergy that would like to return to this tradition, or would like reforms in the church, and would like to change things. Or is that correct?
There are some people who really want there to reform the church, but from which and what point of view? Some of them criticize all this church wealth and so on, but from the kind of Wahhabist point of view, you know, Wahhabist not in the Islamic terms, but from the pure Protestant.
There's a fundamentalist
like in the early Reformation age in Europe. They're not liberals.
Right.
Yeah.
Are there liberals?
Yes, yes. But there are some liberals inside church. So the situation in a Russian Orthodox Church is very complex, very complex. And we can speak about some strong movement inside it. There are a lot of, I think, I'm not an expert in the Russian Orthodox Church, but it seems to me that there are a lot of points of view about what's going on with the church and what to do in the future. But you mentioned that Russian Orthodox Church is not very socially and politically active. It's true. Having in mind the history of Russian Orthodox Church, it was a state church run by the government from the times of Peter the Great. And then after the October Revolution, it was just, you know, an oppression. So the only period when Russian Orthodox Church was, in modern times, was really free, it was between February and November of 1917. Just few months. And that's all.
And after 91.
Yes. But after 1991, you know, all this process with, as we told, church was the part of all this wild capitalism in 1990s. So that is, I think, I am sure, that is the root of the problem.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this develops. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, although I really would like to continue this discussion. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can also read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Please join us again next week. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.